Robin Wright, a professional journalist, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, New Yorker, New York Times, Sunday Times, talking head on so many news programs, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, PBS NewsHour, and the Colbert Report. I just thank you so much for squandering your credibility by talking with me today.
I'm honored to have the opportunity.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 349, Rocking the Casbah. Journalist and scholar Robin Wright has written Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Muslim World, which chronicles youth-inspired Islamic revolts against autocrats and extremism using pop cultural weapons such as music, comedy, and theater, even comic books and theme parks. Because Robin and I were both friends of the late Ambassador Chris Stevens, and since I'm a fan of the pop culture weapons she's writing about, I was very eager to talk to her.
First of all, I just want to compliment you on the title. Titles are hard, and Rock the Casbah, it evokes the clash, but of course that's not the clash you're talking about, is it? It's the clash of cultures.
The title really was the idea of a friend of mine after months of looking at all kinds of titles, you know, the jihad against the jihad, and things that were interesting but might cater only to a narrow audience. He came up with this brilliant idea in a matter of 30 seconds, and it so resonated with both the idea of the Casbah from the Middle East, rock, which was really, the region was rocking with rage and energy and dynamism that we hadn't seen since most of these countries became independent 60 years ago. And so it captured this moment of challenge and energy. But the song also has literal meaning when you look at what the song was about. And it's how a king in obviously a Gulf country does not like the rock and roll, and he dispatches pilots to go off and bomb a concert, and they in the air turn around and decide, no, they like this music, and they start blaring it from their cockpit. And so it's a challenge to the system, to the autocrats who are dictating what they can and can't do, what people can and can't listen to. So it plays out on lots of levels, both for the specialist who knows the region, for people who love that song and know the words, and for the people who are actually out on the streets of Cairo and Tunis and Tripoli to, you know, challenge regimes.
Tell me about the book sort of generally. You're talking about cultural change within the Islamic world, not political, except in that it sort of precedes the political change.
Well, it was such an interesting experience to go out, go across the Middle East and realize that what was happening was the culture of change was the flashpoint, the trigger for the politics of change, and how it resonated with our own experience. I think you're in my generation with during the Vietnam movement, women's rights, civil rights, when whether it was music or comedy or song, poetry, plays, gave voice to ideas that then gained popular acceptance and then began to change the political realm. And that's what's happening in the Middle East. And you're seeing it play out, whether it's in among playwrights who are writing about jihad and have the idea of jihad in the title, but they're reclaiming the idea of jihad from the extremists. They're writing about the jihad, which is the daily struggle to be a good person. And they write about it in raucous comedies like Till Jihad Do Us Part, which is a play on the marital vow. And the idea is that the jihad is really how to be a good partner or spouse in a relationship. And another one is Jihad Jones and the Kalashnikov Babes, which was written by an Egyptian. And it's, again, a comedy, but it takes the idea of jihad in the title, and the comedy is all about the stereotypes about Muslims, and it makes fun of them and faces it head on and also tries to educate what jihad really is and how it's been skewered and hijacked by extremists. and what the Islamic faith is really all about. And in many ways, it is particularly comedy, which takes these topics head on and makes fun of them and lets us get beyond our fears. We begin to laugh. And that's so important. When fear has defined our relationship with the Islamic world, really, since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, and everyone's been so nervous about how it's played out and the tensions between Islam and the West, be it hostage takings from the American embassy. I lived in Beirut for 5 years, and I was there during the two attacks on the American embassy and the bombing of the American Marine compound, the largest loss of U.S. military life in a single incident since World War II to this day. And so we've had this incredibly tense period that's defined in many ways the kind of alternative Cold War, in some places a hot war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and helps us understand that the war is really about extremism. It's not about a confrontation with a whole faith.
Well, and I love that notion that cultural change precedes political change, and that particularly comedy can change the world. We're actually writing a show right now about the history of comedy, so that's an intriguing notion for me. But it also, it's an answer, you know, to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show will often downplay what he does, saying, oh, well, we're not trying to change the world, we just want to make people laugh. And yes, you have to make people laugh first, because if they don't laugh, then nothing else works. But your point is that comedy is kind of, entertainment, pop culture, is sort of setting the building blocks for political change.
Absolutely. Let me take rap first. I have a whole chapter in my book about hip-hop Islam and the fact that in the months preceding the uprising, the first uprising in Tunisia, where it all began, there was a young rapper named El General, and he put a song on his Facebook page with lyrics that were more scathing than any politician had ever been about the president. And he talked about how people were living off garbage and the police were corrupt. And he put a video on, and it's a wonderful video where he walks through an alley of garbage with his face shielded so you can't see exactly who he is. And he goes into this old studio with a big RKO mic and sings his lyrics into it. And it was in that environment that a young fruit vendor challenged a government inspector when she demanded a bribe. And he said no. And then she confiscated his fruit and his $100 scale and depriving him of a livelihood. And he supported his five siblings, mother and uncle. And he then went from government office and government office trying just to get his fruit back. And when he couldn't, he went to the governor's office and he covered himself with paint thinner and he set himself on fire. And he literally, physically ignited the uprising, and it was the protests over how he had been treated that then erupted across Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab uprising. And what was fascinating was as people protested, they sang the song of the young rapper, El General, and his words about the corruption of the regime and people starving and getting no education and not being able to have a future. And so you see this mix of culture and politics, and it's played out in comedy so vibrantly as well. In Egypt, at the height of the uprisings in Cairo at Tahrir Square, a young cardiac surgeon who has a funny bone decided that he wanted to start a mock news show modeled on Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart was his hero. And so he did the first shows that he just put on the internet, and he had a banner he made with a cost him $100 that put up on a wall, and he made these jokes, and he had a mock news program about what was happening in the uprising. This show really resonated, and it was very soon picked up by the biggest channel in the Middle East. It now runs 3 times a week, and it's very sophisticated, and it's become so controversial that he was arrested by the Egyptian government for insulting the Muslim Brotherhood leadership. And he said to me when I interviewed him for this book, how much he wanted to be on Jon Stewart. And did I have any way of helping him? And I said I'd been on Colbert twice, but I'd never done Stewart. But he, one of his proudest achievements is that he's appeared twice on Stewart now, once before he was arrested and then soon afterwards. And he's become a celebrity, and he has more viewers now than the president of Egypt received at the polls when he was elected.
So there's hope for all of us, is what you're saying. There's hope for every comedian.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Susan Stamberg at National Public Radio. Guess what you're listening to? The ridiculous, no, it's a reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Our run of the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged, revised, closes this weekend at the Leicester Square Theater in London on August 17th. So run, don't walk, catch us there if you can before we head back out on our fall UK tour. And then in addition to the UK, this fall we'll bring Shakespeare, all the great books, the ultimate Christmas show, and the new show, The Complete History of Comedy Abridged, to the US, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information.
We know each other. We met because we were both friends of Ambassador Chris Stevens, the U.S. Ambassador to Libya who was killed last September 11th. How did you know Chris? How did you meet him?
I met Chris when he was a young desk officer at the State Department, when he was really just starting out. And he'd made a bold decision, as you know better than I, since you've known him longer, that he wasn't going to be a rich lawyer in California. He was going to chuck it all to go to Washington and work in a tedious bureaucracy because he believed in understanding the world and doing something about its problems. And he had such a genuine energy and enthusiasm about these hell holes that where I've spent most of my life. And so we clicked automatically, and we'd have long lunches and we'd talk about Iran at that time because controversial subject. There aren't many people who've been to Iran, and I used to go almost every year. I still go regularly, but I don't get visas as often. And so it started over Iran, and then we would meet up in all the places he was posted, in Damascus when I'd travel with secretaries of state and he'd be the person at the embassy. Or when we were doing peace plan shuttles and he would be in Jerusalem and we'd make the trips to Ramallah, to the West Bank, to see the Palestinians, and then to the, and then in, you know, in Riyadh, everywhere I went, right. Chris was always there. And we continued our conversations along the way.
Well, I'm fascinated because obviously I knew him in high school and college, and when he was just like the rest of us, a goofball. Was he a goofball in his job? How did he do his job?
You know, this is the fun part, that Chris, as you know, was so incredibly genuine.
Yeah.
And there was no BS about him. Right. There were no errors. And he really enjoyed people. You know, any kind of people. He was not a diplomatic snob. He always struck me, and I wrote this in the Washington Post after he died, that he knew the people of the streets as well as the elites. And in every country I went to, Chris had great stories about the kind of engagement he had with the locals. He'd go and sit on the floor and drink tea with them. When I went to Libya shortly after he died, and we had communicated about this trip just a week before he died, I went to see one of the top commanders in the militia, in the leading militia in Tripoli. And he said that he realized that Libya might be able to go back to normalcy the day that he started seeing Chris jog by his headquarters. And that's what American diplomacy is all about. And the tragedy in, not just since 9/11, but really since the first suicide bomb started in the early 1980s, is that American embassies have become fortresses and American diplomats don't go out. And Chris did. Everywhere he went, as dangerous as they were, as unwelcome as Americans were, he would always get out there. And he has, there were these stories everywhere. Yeah. Once during the height of tensions between the Palestinians and the Israelis, he went out on a rare night of snow in Jerusalem, and he hauled out one of the younger officers, and they started having a snowball fight in the area between where the two Israelis and the Palestinians were kind of facing each other. And both sides ended up joining the snowball fight. I mean, this is where he was very much still the goofball he was in high school, but he knew how to use human fun and the human dimension to benefit diplomacy and to ease tensions. And that was an extraordinary gift that you don't find among a lot of diplomats.
One of the things that I really liked about reading the book is that you see a side, just on a basic level, you see a side of the Muslim world that we don't see, that Americans don't see. It's only the squeaky wheels that get the grease. It's only the freaks and the radicals on every edge of the spectrum that get the news. And, you know, if you travel to these countries, you find, oh, look, they're just people like us that they want to have, you know, they want to have dinner and take care of their kids and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's one of the eye-opening things about reading the book. And I wish there were a way to get more people to, well, read the book, but also hear these kinds of stories. You know what I mean?
Well, the problem with journalism, I can say as a journalist of many years for many different news organizations, is that you never have the space or the time to write the good news. It's always what people need to know, what the bad news is, what they need to prepare for, what the trends are. And that's why I've gone back and forth between writing books and journalism, because in writing a book, I can be more substantive and meaty. And I always try to find narratives of people to illustrate and make and suck in readers so that they get so caught up in reading about that particular character. They want to know what happens to him. And along the way, they have to read all the other stuff that I'm going to tell them about. But there are great characters in the Middle East. This is such a turning point. And we lose sight in the daily headlines of the violence or the uncertainty politically, the instability, the economic woes, that the basic factors that produced change that led to this, an unprecedented wave of empowerment across the Arab world, really are still there. It's the young generation. They know the outside world. They get what's happened elsewhere in the last quarter century with the end of communism in Eastern Europe and the demise of apartheid and minority rule in Africa and the collapse of military dictatorships in Latin America, that they get this global change and they want to be part of it. It's going to take us a long time to get there. And as pessimistic as we all can be justifiably short term, you know, long term, when you look at, again, our example, the fact it took us, we went through a very bloody civil war to end slavery. And then it took us a century until we got to the Civil Rights Act and even, you know, longer till we got a black could run and actually be fairly elected to the presidency. Mm-hmm. Change takes a long time. I mean, in the Soviet Union today, a generation later, you have Russia still led by a former communist and KGB chief. That in South Africa, the average black is worse off today than he was under apartheid. The average lifespan has gone from 61 years the day that Nelson Mandela walked to freedom to 40 years today. I mean, this is tangible.
Yeah.
That change takes a long time, and it's not going to be like a light switch you turn on and off. And it's just that we're impatient. But all the things that have produced the comedy and the rap and the theater and the poetry that challenges extremism as well as autocracy is still there. And that's what's going to lead us in new directions, in many ways more than the politicians over the next generation.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your rebellions via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Sultan of Silly Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Catherine Edmonds. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Susan Stamberg from National Public Radio. I'll leave you with our little foray into Muslim comedy with this excerpt from the Complete Millennium musical abridged called Do Let's Be Frank About the Muslims. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 349 1047ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Everyone's afraid to talk. They stutter, stammer, or just gawk. No one wants to be the first to move. But if we're going to do this, we have to say, oh, screw this. One look at Muslim history shows they've got nothing to prove. Do let's be frank about the Muslims. The time for speaking plainly has begun. They all bow down to Mecca. They're wonderful as hecka. They really are an awful lot of fun. Their empire was Ottoman. They had an awful lot of men who were scientists, philosophers, and sages. Not all of them are Bedouins. They practiced modern medicine when the Western world was still in the Dark Ages. So do let's be frank about the Muslims. Yes, I know they seem exotic to a foreigner, but all their men and women invented coffee up in Yemen. Blame them for every Starbucks on your corner. Now there were many popes who were absolutely dopes, who I'd really love to take and shake and throttle, because they kept down Greek philosophy. But fortunately for you and me, a Muslim man translated a lot of Aristotle. So do let's be frank about the Muslims. Let's celebrate.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.